most important, both a strong sense of purpose and an energizing sense of fun. After all, battling the bastards is about as much fun as you can have with your clothes on. This is Jim Hightower saying, Reclaim Chicago is not merely an election apparatus, but a democracy movement, building a permanent progressive majority that functions year-round, year after year, so the people truly can become self-governing. Contact them at reclaimchicago.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
And that does it for The Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Hanalee Myers. Now it's time for Connections. Today, host Roger Wendell speaks with Dr. Philip Cafaro, an author and philosophy professor at the Colorado State University. Today's conversation will look at environmental ethics, consumption, population issues, and wildlands preservation, and probably more. That's on Connections, coming up in just a moment. As always, your calls will be welcome. Stay tuned.
This portion of KGNU programming is supported by you, the KGNU listener member, and by IndresNet, providing internet services for Boulder County and the Front Range. IndresNet can be reached at 303-546-9151.
Talk.
Talk show.
Talk back.
Talk radio.
Talk your talk.
Walk your talk.
KGNU talk.
Call in.
Call in and talk.
Call in and connect.
Connections.
Friday mornings at 8:30.
On KGNU.
Good morning, Colorado, and welcome to Connections. It is the 27th of March, 2015. I'm your host this morning, Roger Wendell. And my guest this morning in studio is Dr. Philip Cafaro. He's author of How Many Is Too Many? The Progressive Argument for Reducing Immigration into the United States, available through the University of Chicago Press Books. Dr. Philip Cafaro is a philosophy professor at Colorado State University in Fort Collins. His main research interests center on environmental ethics, consumption, population issues, and wildlands preservation. In addition to How Many Is Too Many, Dr. Cafaro is author of Thoreau's Living Ethics and co-editor of the anthology Life on the Brink, Environmentalists Confront Overpopulation. Dr. Cafaro, welcome to KGNU.
Good to be here, Roger. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. I hope to cover population issues, especially immigration's contribution to our overpopulation problem, along with related environmental concerns, economics, and inequality, and declining wages for American poor as a result of immigration. But first, tell us a little bit about yourself politically. Are you a conservative, a progressive, a Democrat, a Republican? Where are you at on the political spectrum?
Well, over the years, I've always thought of myself as a progressive. I'm interested in creating a more egalitarian society, a society that shares wealth more equally. I'm particularly concerned with stagnating wages for working-class Americans. A lot of my political work has been centered around environmental issues, and again, I tend to see that as a progressive goal, creating an ecologically sustainable society. So I'm, if you had to put me somewhere, I would say left of center. Now, having said that, I don't really think that the Democratic Party today, whether in Colorado or nationally, is a truly progressive party anymore. So I don't call myself a Democrat anymore, although when I can bring myself to vote, I tend to vote for Democratic candidates.
Okay, very good. Well, we welcome all political persuasions here at KGNU and appreciate your candor. Before getting into immigration, I'd like to discuss Population 101, as it were. Can you help us understand human population levels throughout history, where we're at now around the world, and especially here in this country, America?
Sure. Well, worldwide, we're in the midst of a population explosion. It took us until about 1800 or so worldwide to reach 1 billion people on planet Earth. And we reached 2 billion by about 1930. And today we're at 7.3 billion or so. So we're on a rapid upward trajectory at the moment, globally. We're also on an upward trajectory here in the United States. We've quadrupled our population since 1900, and we're on track to just about double it by 2100. So both globally and worldwide, we're starting to, thankfully, the slope of the curve isn't quite as steep as it used to be, but we're still rapidly increasing populations.
So apparently the curve is leveling off a little bit worldwide, but here in this country it's a different story.
Well, leveling off, I mean, yeah, it's slowing. It's less steep than it was. And the hope of many of us is that it will level off globally. But I would say right now it's just slowing down.
I'm new to Colorado. I didn't move here until 1972. But since that time, in those 40 or 45 odd intervening years, population in this state has over doubled. The population of our country has doubled since my birth, which is a little bit before then, of course. And the world's population has actually tripled. Can you give us a sense of what population is doing to our planet? And again, I promise we are going to talk about immigration, but I want to get kind of this 101 population issue out of the way first. What's happening to the planet as a result of Colorado's population doubling, U.S. population doubling, and these numbers we've been throwing about so far?
Well, not surprisingly, the more people you have, the more environmental impact you're going to have. The more resources those people are going to need, the more pollution they're going to generate on down the line. Now, in my book, I talk about some specific issues that people in Colorado are very concerned with, such as sprawl, and I talk about the specific connections between more people needing more land for various purposes. But, you know, if you think about it, there's really no environmental issue that would be easier to deal with if we had twice as many people. So the impact of tripling world population in the past 50 years has just been astounding. I tend to think of it this way. The two main drivers of our environmental problems are growing human numbers and growing human economies and the increased per capita demands that we've been making. And those two things are related.
Let's talk about the environment a little bit more and the impact human population has on that. Certainly big in the news, maybe the number one environmental concern is climate change or global warming. I know we still have a few deniers out there, but again, as I expressed earlier, I've been around for a while. I've seen some changes even in the weather here and my travels around the country. But, you know, they're advocating reductions in carbon emissions. Is that even possible if we continue to grow at the rates we've been growing at, or even maybe slightly reduced rates? We've kind of suggested there may be a trend towards leveling off a little bit. But tell us about carbon emissions and population. I know you talk about that quite a bit in your book as well.
Right, right. Well, it might be possible for us to continue to grow our population and decrease carbon emissions if we had sufficient efficiency improvements. What's probably not possible is for us to decrease carbon emissions as much as we need to avoid catastrophic climate change and still continue to grow our population. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has been very clear in this. When they talk about the drivers of climate change and the possible mitigating factors around climate change, they talk about four factors: increased population and increased per capita energy use are the great drivers of increased carbon emissions. Now, moving in the other direction are improvements in energy efficiency, which allow us to use less energy per person, and then increases in so-called carbon efficiency, where we're using the same amount of energy, but we generate less carbon. So, for instance, if we switch to more wind power, we could use as much electricity, but we're generating less carbon. So those are the four factors that the climate scientists tell us are behind carbon emissions. And so really, in order to drive carbon emissions down, ideally we would want to be working on all those factors. We would want to have increased efficiency in energy use and carbon use, but we would also want to be stabilizing and perhaps even reducing the human population, and perhaps even looking to stabilize economic growth instead of ratcheting it ever more upward.
We do hear a lot about carbon emissions and reducing that impact on the planet, but I don't think I often hear any reference to population as far as the four items you've suggested here as a solution or resolution to this problem. Why is it we don't hear much about population when it comes to carbon emissions or, for that matter, anything else? I don't hear about population ever, and it seems crowded to me.
Yeah, well, I think in the United States, at least, I can't speak for activists around the world, but in the United States, I think environmental leaders have made a very conscious decision not to talk about population issues. And it's interesting, if you go back to the dawn of the modern environmental movement, late 60s, early 70s, a tremendous amount of discussion about population. People drew the obvious connections between population growth and sprawl, population growth and pollution. And it's not that those connections aren't there anymore. It's that our leaders, both our political leaders and our environmental leaders, have decided that it's just too uncomfortable to talk about population. Why have they done that? Well, that's a complicated story. But I think it's because it's so easy to annoy people on the left and the right ends of the political spectrum and in the center. I mean, if you talk about population growth, and ways to avoid population growth, you might well wind up talking about family planning and abortion, and that tends to enrage people on the conservative side, especially abortion. On the other hand, the main driver of population growth in the developed world and in the United States certainly today is immigration. And if you talk the way I do in my book about reducing immigration, that tends to piss off people on the left side. So in the face of this, environmental leaders have decided not to talk about population growth. And I think it's a tremendous mistake because, as the scientists tell us, population growth is helping drive climate change. It's helping drive overfishing in ocean fisheries. It's helping drive our pollution issues here in the United States. It's driving sprawl here in Colorado. And, you know, it's funny, if you want to talk with your local officials here about sprawl development, it's fine to talk about zoning changes. You might be able to talk a little bit about more progressive transportation policies. But if you say to them, oh, and by the way, you know, we're just going to have a lot more sprawl if we double our population, then they can't talk about that. And again, it's a failure of political will.
8:43 is the time. You're listening to Connections. My guest this morning is Dr. Philip Cafaro. He's a philosophy professor out of Colorado State University and author of How Many is Too Many? The Progressive Argument for Reducing Immigration into the United States. And we welcome your participation in this conversation. You can call the studio now at 303-442-4242. Again, that's 442-4242. Dr. Cafaro, backing up just a little bit, I noticed in the book that you did define sprawl, and I wonder if we could delve into that just for a moment. I know that there's kind of leapfrogging when it comes to development, and especially in places like Aurora, where I grew up, but give us a better idea of what actually sprawl is.
Well, people talk about sprawl in different ways. Some people just think of it as any sort of development, new development of one sort or another. Other people try to define it a little more narrowly, and they say development along the edges of an existing community. Maybe that's not sprawl, but leapfrog development further out. I think the simplest way to think about sprawl is simply to think about it as the development of agricultural and open lands that have not previously been built on in a concentrated way.
As the curmudgeon from 1972 that I mentioned earlier, you know, it's been obvious to me growing up here in the Denver area that things have gotten considerably more crowded. But on a personal level, for the average person, the average listener, who would be younger and maybe doesn't remember the days back when there were no traffic jams on I-25 or I-70. Are people realizing on a personal level that things are a little bit more crowded or a little bit more competitive, or are we kind of like the proverbial frogs in the boiling pot? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think in general people, I talk to a lot of students about this up at CSU, and if they grew up in the Denver metro area, they've seen the growth, they've seen increased traffic. So I think a lot of people are on this. I think our citizens are more on it than our politicians. Our politicians like to pretend that we can double our population and it's not going to make your daily commute any more miserable. They have various solutions that they put forward. But we know that those solutions are only partial solutions, and that doubling the population of Colorado is going to make Colorado a worse place to live. So, again, I think people understand this at a very, very gut level, and especially in a state like Colorado, where connecting to nature is so important to so many of us. I think it's just obvious that if you have a lot more people, they're going to need space to live, and we're going to need more roads, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to be a little harder for you to get out of town and to get to those places that connect up to nature. When you get there, you might well find a crowd instead of quiet space to commune with nature. So I think people understand this. Maybe what they don't understand is that there's an alternative, that we don't have to just keep growing. Maybe that's the missing piece.
We'll get to the phones in just a moment. Mike, Bob, and others are waiting patiently, and we appreciate that potential participation. And like I say, we'll get to you in just a moment. Hang on there on the phones. But folks in general around the world, do they view population pressure the same way we do? And the reason I bring this up is because China had a one-child policy that was relatively strictly enforced for many years, depending on where you were at class-wise in their society, but they seem to have forgotten that a little bit. So maybe the Chinese are an example, but give us a sense of how the world looks at population, and maybe how the world even looks at U.S. population.
Well, people around the world have a wide range of different takes on population, partly because people around the world in different countries are facing very different demographic futures. I mean, if you go to a country like India, for instance, I was traveling there maybe 10 years or so ago, and I talked to government officials, I talked to taxi drivers, I talked to anyone I could about population issues, and they all see it as very important because it's right in their face. They understand that they have a lot more young people than they have jobs for those young people. They understand that their cities have just ballooned and sewage treatment hasn't kept up with it. I mean, all you have to do is walk along the rivers and open your nose, and it's very obvious that those are real problems. So in a place like India, people have one take on population. In countries in Eastern Europe, where they have very low fertility rates and they're actually concerned about having enough workers to support the next generation of retirees, they have very different concerns about population. So really, it's a very mixed bag around the world. And we should mention, by the way, that there's been a tremendous amount of success in various countries around the world at slowing and even ending population growth. So we don't want to leave the impression that this is just something that's out of our control. If we give people free or easy access to contraception, and if we create the kind of society where we approve of women and couples choosing how many children to have, there's good evidence from around the world that that can lead to a rapid drop in fertility and countries getting a handle on population growth.
So I'm assuming, though, most of the countries you're referencing in general are making a conscious effort at reducing population or stabilizing it. But what comes to mind for me is, for example, Putin in Russia is advocating more childbirths in Russia. And Japan, as we speak, is lamenting the aging of their population, and they're trying to find ways to make the younger people more fertile with tax incentives. And you're nodding your head in agreement. So Russia, Japan maybe are bucking the trend.
Yeah, I think it's very different in different places. in Russia, they're really looking at population decline over the next couple decades. And I think we've seen that Mr. Putin has pretty ambitious goals for Russia, and I don't think a declining population is part of his vision for Russia in the future. Similarly, in Japan, you're right, there is a lot of worry about low fertility rates, and there are some efforts by the government to increase that. But, you know, you have to bring in other aspects too, especially the environmental aspect. Japan is a tremendously crowded country. It's true their population has started to slowly decline. I think in the last couple of years it's registered a decline of a couple billion people. But that's with a very dense population. So you have to look at Japan and say, well, you know, maybe the future of Japan is one where its population eventually levels off at half of what it is right now. Maybe Japan and the world as a whole can't accommodate as many Japanese as there are there right now. And I think we might ask similar questions about the United States. We're at about 320, 325 million people in the United States.
Is that counting illegal immigrants or undocumented?
Yeah, if you threw in the undocumented, maybe we're up to 330 million, something like that.
So a third billion.
A third of a billion people. In 1900, we had 76 million people in the United States. So it's not written anywhere that the United States can support, for any great length of time, a third of a billion people. That number might well have to come down. Again, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty about these questions, but it seems kind of foolish to me that we would just want to keep growing and then see if we can hit that limit. let's try to leave some ecological space for future generations to live and live well.
Looking at this from another angle, though, and zeroing in on Colorado again, I wonder if people wouldn't consider it selfish on the part of this curmudgeon and yourself, being considerably younger, that we want to put up barriers and keep people out of Colorado. We just want this for ourselves. I mean, you've apparently heard that argument. What's your response?
Yeah, I think a large part of environmentalism is saying, I do want certain things for myself and my family and my community. I want to create a good community to live in. I want to preserve wild nature, both for other species and for the benefit of people who can then appreciate them. And that's nothing to apologize for, any more than we need to apologize for wanting to create a society that is more egalitarian or that upholds human rights. So I don't think environmentalists should apologize for our desires to preserve our state or our nation. And beyond that, I don't really think it's unselfish to say, let's just keep growing, let's keep increasing our population. I think that's actually disastrous for the world as a whole. You know, if you look at climate change, if you look at increased ocean acidification, if you look at some of these global limits that we seem to be hitting up against, the last thing we need in dealing with those kind of problems is a lot more of Americans. Because we use a lot of resources, we generate a lot of carbon.
Indeed. 8:53 is the time, and I promise we will talk about immigration specifically and some of the economics associated with that. We've got nearly full lines, so let's go to the phones. And it looks like Mike's been waiting the longest. Mike, good morning. You're on Connections.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. You're on the air.
All right. My question, actually, I'd like you to address a dramatic future that we are facing. You talk about population growth and global climate change. Well, my understanding, when those lines cross, there's going to be an incredible collapse of environment, but also as the oceans rise with the global warming, the collapse of populations. We've seen disasters in the Philippines and Vanuatu with hurricanes, but my understanding is the oceans rise, Bangladesh, many countries in the world are going to experience difficulties in keeping populations. There's going to be a migration. The UN Institute on Migration estimates half a billion people by the turn of the middle of the century, will be displaced by climate change. Can you address that, please?
Yeah, there's more and more talk about the potential of so-called climate refugees. As climate change worsens, we can see increased storms and storm surges in certain places. We could imagine, or we're already seeing, and we can imagine further increases in sea level, and that could make large areas of Bangladesh, for instance, or the Mekong Delta in Vietnam uninhabitable, and those people are going to have to go somewhere. So, again, I mean, I think those are going to be very difficult issues for future generations to deal with. That's even more of a reason for us to try to create a sustainable society right now and to try to stabilize our population.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Mike?
Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Bob's been waiting a long time as well. Bob, good morning. You're on Connections.
Yes, I'd like to make a few comments. I could rant and rave forever. But what I see happening is there's too many wars, plus the United States pouring all that money into armaments and sending arms to all over the world, when they should be here taking care of the environment. And when the Europeans came here and subjected all the Native Americans and people that were here, they subjected them to tyrannical outcomes. And they did the same in South America when they went there, and the United States is now there. That put in all these dictators, and then they destroyed the economies.
So Bob, your point being then that we're not focusing on the environment or population as much as we should. We're
yes.
too in. Okay, we'll let our guest comment. Bob, thank you so much for the question.
Oh, sure.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I agree. I think you know, given all our problems at home, given increased inequality, given our failure to create an ecologically sustainable society, and moving further and further away from that. I think we do need to focus more of our efforts and resources on creating the kind of society we need here and get away from this idea that we know enough to decide how people are going to live other places.
And if I could put some words into Bob's mouth, he's left us here. Here's a talk show host of Czechoslovakian descent kind of dictating to what Native Americans have laid claim to. And I often wonder, what does the Native American community think of the population at this point? I'm sure they're not enamored with it, but my guess would be they don't want to have any more people here than we would.
Yeah, I wouldn't presume to speak for them. I've talked to one or two Native Americans who've said exactly that. But, you know, chances are if you get into the details of immigration policy, for instance, Native Americans are going to have a variety of views just like other groups of Americans.
Certainly. 8:58 is the time. You're listening to Connections. My guest this morning is Philip Cafaro. He's author of How Many is Too Many? The Progressive Argument for Reducing Immigration into the United States. And you're listening to KGNU Boulder, KGNU Denver, 1390 AM and 88.5 FM. Let's go back to the phones. We do have one open line at 303-442-4242. Lori's been waiting a long time. Lori, good morning. You're on Connections.
Morning. This is a very thought-provoking conversation. I appreciate it. But there's something you said that really got me thinking, and that was the hope to have your future generations live and live well. And it got me thinking about what is the percentage of people on the earth today that actually live and live well? Or what percentage throughout history have been allowed to live and live well? And I wonder that if maybe to avoid having it sound like an elitist approach or a simplistic approach by saying we need to cut down immigration so that our children and our grandchildren can live and live well, maybe we ought to be looking into how do we let all of the Earth's population live and live well. And we know that things like education and increased opportunities lead to population decrease. And I would suggest that's maybe a better answer.
Yeah, I think it's part of the right answer, certainly. There's an awful lot that the United States can do to help poorer countries to bring education to their citizens. I think we could be much more generous, and I say in my book that we could be much more generous and intelligent in how we target our foreign aid to other countries. But I also think we have a special responsibility to create a just and sustainable society here in the United States. And like it or not, that involves setting population policies. So one of the things we've done right over the last 30, 40 years is bring our fertility rates down so that we can accommodate a reasonable amount of immigration and stabilize our population in a couple decades. Instead, we're pursuing a mass immigration strategy, mostly for economic reasons. We want more workers, we want more consumers, et cetera, et cetera. And we're on track because of that to double our population approximately in 2100. Now, we can't create a sustainable society by doubling our population and by continuing to increase our population. So as unpleasant as it might be for progressives to think about these things, I think we also have to consider taking immigration, reducing it.
Lori, thanks for the question. And let's focus then a little bit more on immigration. In your book, you write, just because Rush Limbaugh and his ilk want to close our borders does not necessarily mean progressives should be for opening them wider. Can you expand on that a little bit more?
Yes, I think progressives hear conservatives talking about this issue and they don't like what they hear. They suspect that it's motivated by racism. They don't, the law and order aspect of it doesn't appeal to them all that much. And they look at immigrants as a group and they say they're good people for the most part. They just want to make a life for themselves and their families. And they'd say, well, if Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck are for reducing immigration, then I must be for increasing it. And I think that's a mistake. I think we need to go back to our progressive principles and take a look at what current immigration levels are doing in terms of undermining our ability to achieve those principles. We've talked a little bit about environmental issues. We haven't yet talked about the impact of mass immigration on working class Americans. And it's very negative. It's immigration into the United States is, for the most part, bringing in people with less education and less training than the average American. And so the economic impact in terms of direct reduction of wages has tended to fall hardest on those Americans who are least able to bear that. So if you take a look at the percentages of immigrants in different categories of the economy, very high percentages in construction and agriculture, in janitorial services, very high percentages in meatpacking. And these are jobs that haven't just had stagnating wages, but actually in many cases declining wages in recent decades. Now, if we just allow mass immigration to continue, we can expect that those same Americans will fall farther and farther behind. And conversely, wealthier Americans tend to benefit from very high levels of immigration. They don't directly compete with immigrants for the most part in the workplace, and yet they're well positioned to benefit from lower prices for goods and services. So mass immigration is a great recipe, a great equation for increasing inequality. And as progressives, we should not want that.
I like talking about numbers a little bit more as well. Not in your book, but elsewhere in your work, when I was preparing for the program today, I think you mentioned that an increase of 500,000 immigrants in the year 2014, 2015 would result in 75 million more people in this country by the year 2100. So What impact does immigration actually have on our population? Is it a disproportionate impact?
Yeah, let me give you a few figures about that again from the book. What I actually say in the book is for each 500,000 immigrants brought in annually into the United States between now and the end of the century, that will translate into roughly 72 million more Americans in 2100. So if we imagine, currently we're bringing in about 1.25 million immigrants annually, and that has us on track to increase our population from about 325 million to 525 million. So current immigration levels, we are on track to add 200 million more people to the United States. Now, if we instead cut back to the immigration levels of half a century ago, so bring in about 250,000 immigrants annually, and that would still be relatively generous from a worldwide perspective, but if we cut back to 250,000 immigration annually, our population would instead stabilize at around 380 million. Now, conversely, if we passed the comprehensive immigration bill that Senator Bennett helped draft in the previous Congress, we could increase immigration to about 2.25 million annually, and that would lead to a population of approximately 670 million in 2100. So relatively small changes in annual immigration accumulate, and they lead to huge differences in our population in 2100. So this gives you a sense of what's at stake if you're concerned about the environmental impacts of immigration in this country.
You mentioned a few moments ago, though, the economic impact, especially on poorer Americans or laborers, as it were. But typically, a lot of the immigrants, illegal and some legal, are engaged in agriculture, construction. I think you mentioned meat packing even in the book. Americans aren't willing to do that work.
That's what you typically hear, but if you look at the figures in something like meatpacking, let's say, I mean, that's a sector which is very heavily immigrant labor within there. But still, a majority of workers within meatpacking plants are native-born American workers. So these are actually jobs that Americans will do, and they're jobs that Americans need to do for the money, to support their family, for their self-respect. When you turn now to construction, again, an awful lot of immigrants in construction in Colorado and in the country as a whole, but the majority of workers are native-born American workers. And it's really striking that in a sector which has had, for many of recent decades, really has boomed, that has not translated into increased wages for construction workers. At best, they tend to be holding even, and in some cases, they're falling behind. So this is what we can expect if we just keep flooding labor markets with workers.
908's the time. We've got one open line at 303-442-4242. Let's go back to the phones. Gene has been waiting patiently. Gene, good morning. You're on KGNU.
Good morning. I would say that the conservatives are dishonest as far as closing the borders, precisely as the guest was pointing out. These conservatives, they don't want to give wages to local workers. They don't want to give them benefits, so that's why they bring workers from the South, which are willing to put up with low wages and bad conditions of work. But I would ask a broader question. Is the guest thinking about changing the situation in this country and globally by changing the political economic system? That's my question. And also, how about helping the countries in the Central and South America develop their own economies so that will stem the flow of immigrants and stabilize their governments?
Gene, that's a good point. I think it was mentioned in the book. Dr. Cafaro?
Yeah, excellent points, and I tend to agree with the caller. One of the things I did in writing this book was interview many dozens of workers here in Colorado, both immigrants and non-immigrants. And it was really striking in asking immigrants, why did you come to the United States? Many times what I heard from them was they really felt like they had no choice. They had no options in the countries they were coming from, particularly people coming from Mexico or Central America. And so if we could help people in those countries to create societies where they felt safe as a start, and then societies with more economic opportunity, I think many people would choose to stay where they were born, because it's hard. It's hard moving to a new country and leaving friends and family behind. I heard many stories that really confirmed that. So I would say I agree with the caller. We need to help these countries to create better conditions where they are. There's a lot that the United States, as a wealthy and powerful country, could do to help those countries. And his other point was also a really good one, and that was, what about the economic system itself? I actually get into that somewhat in the book as well, although the book focuses on immigration and population, but both in looking at the economic side and looking at the environmental side, I come around to the view that we really need to rethink this commitment to endless growth. And it's not serving us well in terms of furthering progressive goals, and it's not a sustainable approach to organizing society and organizing our economy. So we need to think harder about what a truly sustainable economy would look like and a post-growth economy would look like. I talk about that some in the book. It's somewhat speculative because I think no one really knows very well what a post-growth economy would look like. From what the scientists are telling us, we need to start moving toward one.
Gene, a final comment?
Yes, a society based on profit. Let's say I have a business, and of course I have a business to have profits. And next year I want to have a little more profit than this year, and so on. And you see my where I'm going with this. If I want more profit and more profit, and I want to show a graph to my investors, if I sell shares, that this is a growing business, that propels, it's a society and political economic system that's based on growth. It has to happen. And in same time, exploitation, meaning I have expenses and I have investments to make, and I need to get the biggest bang for the buck. So our economic system, at least in my judgment, it's kind of in-box thinking as opposed to out-of-the-box thinking if we fail to address the political economic system in cases and issues and themes like we are talking this morning.
A good point, Gene. I think Edward Abbey even alluded to this years ago when he suggested that the mentality of growth is that of a cancer cell. But Dr. Cafaro.
Yeah, again, the caller is bringing up excellent points. Our current economy is predicated on growth. I think if we can stabilize our population, that part of the motivation for ever more growth can be set aside, and maybe we can start to move toward a saner view of how an economy could actually work. You know, it's very interesting. I meet people all the time who are living lives that they're relatively happy with. They're making enough money, and they don't necessarily feel that they need to make 5% more next year than they did last year. It might be nice, but it's not a key to them living well. So when I talk to individuals, we seem to have a sane view of economics. We understand that there are more important things that grow than growth, and that you can even have enough. But then when we scale it up to the level of the economy as a whole, we toss all that out the window and we say we just have to grow. And the caller is absolutely right. We have to fundamentally rethink this. One suggestion that some economists have made is to move more and more towards an economy where more and more of the goods and services delivered are delivered by not-for-profit organizations, or are delivered by worker-owned companies, where maybe you need a certain amount of growth, but providing a proper service or good and having a decent wage for workers is enough for people. So somehow we have to get to an economy that recognizes enough.
Gene, thanks for your contribution. We have full lines. We're going to move along now. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Okay. Strider's been waiting patiently. Strider, good morning. You're on Connections.
Hey. Yeah, I appreciate your discussion, and you're already really on track. The whole globalization thing promoted by corporate capitalism is precisely the race to the bottom, to lower wages and to increase competition. And for the centuries of imperialism, the very same thing. You bring in more workers to lower the wages and to increase production. All of that is destructive to the environment. Henry Wallace, back when he was Secretary of Commerce, back during World War II, promoted that the idea that if we're going to have military contracts, we need to provide a living wage and decent conditions for, you know, for the people on the work doing the work in foreign countries. Globalization could have gone in that direction, but it's gone exactly the opposite, of course, under the domination of capitalism. What I would like to mention, all of these issues you have brought up are really pertinent. The problem, one problem we have is progressive organization tends to singularize and be partisan about given issues, immigrant rights, racism, wages, such as that. And therefore, we bifurcate ourselves to where the only real answer is to look at it comprehensively. Now, the right wing is always against comprehensive thinking, but the left wing, we also tend to fractionalize ourselves. Could you address that in terms of our own partisanship, which often we shoot our own feet because we have similar broad and comprehensive issues, but sometimes they get competitive in terms of who gets the airspace?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think we do need to think comprehensively, but at the same time, we need to look at these issues, creating a just society, creating a sustainable society, at lower scales as well. So here in Colorado, we have a responsibility to ask ourselves, what's a fair sharing of the landscape with other species, for instance? Are we setting aside enough land and water and resources so that we can continue to have populations of all the native species that were here 200 years ago? So, you know, it's important to think about global biodiversity loss, but it's important for us to set policies here in Colorado that that will help us create a sustainable society. At the same, in the same way, we need to try to create economic policies that are good for the majority of people in our state, and that don't just push growth, 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 but that try to make sure that the benefits of that are shared more equitably.
Strider, a quick comment?
We need to be pushing international institutions toward that kind of thinking, because with nothing but global capitalism making the rules, you got China, you got us, you got Europe, you got all of the countries wanting to do more exploitation, and we fight each other over making it worse. We have to do the kind of creation of what the UN might have been, but has not been, to bring this kind of comprehensive sanity and thinking on a global scale. So I'll just leave it with that.
Okay, Strider, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, that makes good sense to me. Why have we made so much progress in the past 20 years at liberalizing trade laws and so little progress in the past 20 years dealing with climate change and our other global environmental problems? Countries, the leaders of countries, have seen increasing trade as a great good, and they've seen protecting the environment as an afterthought, or protecting the rights of workers to organize as an afterthought. So we need to reverse that.
Okay, we have nearly full lines. It's been a busy hour so far. My guest is Dr. Philip Cafaro. He's author of How Many Is Too Many? The Progressive Argument for Reducing Immigration into the United States, available through University of Chicago Press Books. Doctor, I certainly have more questions, but it looks like we have a lot of interested callers, so let's go back to the phones. Robert's been waiting a long time patiently. Robert, good morning. You're on Connections.
Good morning. Thank you. It's always good to hear a little bit about a shared vision for the well-being of all nature and all people on this planet, and trying to address the problems and talk about the negative impacts that especially human beings are having on nature and to each other. And, of course, population, I agree, is a major problem, but it seems to me most problems have multiple causes and multiple solutions. And then we might try to prioritize those. I do not put population growth at the top of that list. I just would like to suggest again that the problem is less about the number of people on the planet and more about the behavior of people on the planet, the choices that human beings are making, and especially in terms of the wasting of resources through average waste and through the catastrophic waste of especially tearing down buildings all over this country and all over the world. There are so many kinds of resources that we are wasting by the billions and billions that have not only a negative impact on the economy and on social structures, but on the environment, because all these things have to be replaced. And then there's the waste from war, which we never hear about. We never hear about the destruction of all the homes and businesses and all of the things that will now have to be taken again from nature, and all the harm this does to people. And by the way, we never seem to talk about, when it comes to impacts of numbers of people, we always talk about that in terms of population growth, but a lot of that comes from population shift. We have people shifting from one place to another for various adverse reasons that we could correct. Even in this country, we're abandoning cities like Detroit by the thousands of people and allowing thousands of good homes and businesses to go into ruin and be torn down.
So, Robert,
because
Robert,
we're neglecting those places.
Robert, we're a little short on help. If I understand the question, it's pretty much the number one priority in your mind's eye is waste, with maybe population second down the line. Dr. Cafaro.
Yeah,
could I just add the last thing? It really comes down to things like selfishness, greed, and indifference to others that, to me, are the most root problems that we need to address.
Dr. Cafaro.
Well, certainly human beings can be selfish and unjust and greedy and all the rest of it. I teach classes in ethics at Colorado State University, so I like to think I'm doing my part to help us improve in a small way. At the same time, we're trying to create just and sustainable societies pretty much with the people that we've got right here. And we can't necessarily expect a global enlightenment before we solve all our problems. So, I'm with you on the idea that there's a tremendous amount of waste in the United States and in other places. I'm with you on the idea that environmentalism should include trying to reduce waste and use resources more efficiently. But I have to part company with you on the idea that somehow that's more important than the total number of people that are here. Because, of course, you can use resources more efficiently and simply take what you've saved and use that to support more people. And then you're going to be using just as many resources. We have a great example of this in California. Over the past three decades, they've made great improvements in using less water per capita. They use about half as much water per capita as they did 30 years ago. But they've got about twice as many people due to immigration. So they're using just as much water, and now they're in the middle of a drought, and they're talking about what they can do with that. So, I mean, arguing that waste or per capita consumption is more important than population is sort of like arguing that the area of a rectangle is more about the width than the length. I mean, if you say that, you don't understand geometry. They're both equally important.
Robert, a quick comment, and we're going to move along.
Well, I don't know, comparing the importance may not be as important as actually bringing waste more to the forefront as a critical part of the solution, and recognizing the extent, because I think we just don't recognize the extent of waste on the planet and what the elimination or the reduction and elimination of waste could do. Thank you.
You bring up a great point. Thank you, Robert.
Let's talk about what the elimination of waste could do. What it could do is open up a space that we then use to give ourselves a little bit of ecological breathing room, and it could open up a space where we can share resources more generously with other species. That's one thing it could do. On the other hand, it could just open up a space for more people consuming more. So we have to make a decision about that.
All right, Robert, thank you. All right, let's take one more call. Tom, you've been waiting quite a while. Good morning. You're on Connections.
Hello, it's
Tom, you're on.
Yes, Tom. Okay. Yeah, I was wondering if your book deals with religion, empire, capitalism, oil, resources, food, drugs, and the destabilization that the United States does around the world for all those things, oil, food, and drugs. Because most of our immigrants are coming in from Central America and South America. And something that was interesting that I didn't know is that with empires, that India and Asia, their populations were stable, and they did not explode until the British took them over back in the 1700s. And it seems to be the same thing when we expand empires, that the same thing happened in South America and in this country. So I was just wondering if you dealt with anything like that. I'm a former Catholic, and I'm one of these guys who believes that birth control should actually be a sacrament.
Okay.
Yeah, I do deal somewhat with religion in the book. I do talk about the short-sightedness of religious leaders who argue against contraception. So I take a pretty strong stand on that. You know, your point about the role that the United States has played in destabilizing other countries, especially in Central America, is a good one. I think people can push it too far, though. I especially among my progressive friends, I often find that they seem to think that all the problems of the world are caused by the United States. We're not that one-sidedly negative in our impacts around the world, and we're not, frankly, all that important, perhaps as important as we think we are. People in Central America have found ways to treat each other like crap for hundreds of years. People in Mexico have found ways to mistreat one another and create a society that's extremely inegalitarian. I don't think you can blame all that on the United States. You can find some things to blame us for, and I would love to see us play a more positive role in pushing, nudging, encouraging other countries to create more egalitarian societies. But I don't want to lay all the world's problems on the United States. And the corollary for that, for our immigration topic, is I don't think everybody around the world who would like to immigrate is simply a victim of U.S. policies.
Tom, a quick comment. We're almost out of time.
No, that was just it. And I'm just looking at how we destabilized the Mideast now and all the problems, you know, from the last administration, the Bush and Cheney administration, millions of people in Syria, Iraq, and now Yemen.
Sure. A topic for a whole other connections. Thanks for your contribution. Dr. Cafaro, unfortunately, we're almost out of time. What's a good way for folks to learn more about this topic, your work, your books?
Well, there are a number of good resources for people who want to learn more about population issues. One very good website is the website of the group Numbers USA. You can Google that. People are welcome to visit my website, philipcafaro.com, for more information about my work on population. And I certainly do hope that they'll read my new book, How Many is Too Many? The Progressive Argument for Reducing Immigration into the United States.
Dr. Cafaro, it's been much too short a time this morning, but thanks for appearing.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Great. My guest has been Dr. Philip Cafaro, PhD. He's author of How Many is Too Many? The Progressive Argument for Reducing Immigration into the United States, available through the University of Chicago Press Books. My apologies to Lynn and the others that we couldn't get off the phones this morning, just simply ran out of time, but definitely want to thank Ava for handling the busy phones this morning. And up next is Meredith with the Morning Sound Alternative. I'm Roger Wendell. You've been listening to Connections. Thanks for supporting your community radio station, KGNU. Have a great day. Here's the Zen Cowboys to get you going.
Oh, baby.
Na-na-na-na, counter-counter-counter-culture. It's a necessary thing. Set your mind free. Counter, counter, counter culture. Tell you what's the next thing. Well, is it cool to be like your boy? Or should you be like?
After day, I'm more confused. Yet I look for the light through the pouring rain. You know that's the game I hate to lose. I'm feeling the strain. Ain't it a shame? Wanna give it a beat for the free my soul. Don't get lost in your rock and roll. I'm wasting time. I don't understand things I do. The world outside looks so unkind. Now I'm counting on you to carry me through. Oh, I'm giving up people to free my soul. Thank you. that you've given me. I want you to know I believe in your soul. Rhythm and rhyme and harmony helping me along, keeping me strong. Oh, I'm giving a beat for to free my soul. I want to get lost in your rock and roll and drift away. Oh, I'm giving a beat for to free my